We have a very limited amount of time. Ostensibly, I have 33 minutes to present a very, very complex topic, but we'll spend a few extra minutes. Anybody who has to leave at 3, don't feel obligated to stay longer. I won't keep you, hopefully, too much longer than that, but I want to begin with a few thank yous, because as everyone here knows, I am not a physician. I'm not a medical doctor. I'm only a half a dentist. Bekoshi, half a dentist. Bekoshi, I can only do removable partial dentures. I can't do full dentures, but I could do RPDs, I can. So this topic, which was brought to my attention several weeks ago by a physician in our community, at first glance, I replied to him when he sent over the information. I said, this is beyond the scope of my knowledge, and it'll take me way too much effort, if even possible, to research it to give an adequately intelligent presentation. And then I thought about it some more. I'm a little bit of a glutton for punishment, so I'm like, you know what? Let me just go for it and spend some time to see if I can really immerse myself in this area and get an understanding of what is a very complex and important topic. So I reached out to several people who were immensely helpful, one of whom was Rabbi Yaakov Neuberger. Rabbi Yaakov Neuberger is a Rosh Yeshiva at Reitz at YU. He is also a rabbi of a very prominent synagogue in Bergenfield called Beth Abraham, and he fields many, a myriad of halachic questions related to medicine, because he himself was the rabbi of the Einstein Synagogue for 4 years, and so he has a great expertise in medical halacha. So that was one lengthy conversation. Another lengthy conversation was with my mentor and my teacher, the great Rabbi Dr. Eddie Reichman, who is a preeminent scholar of medical halacha. He's a practicing ER doctor in New York, and he lectures around the world. He's been here, and he's been everywhere. So he was very gracious to review my outline and to share his time. In our own community, Dr. Chaim Huss, who was very gracious to share time, he is a surgical oncologist, I believe that's what his title is, in a hospital not far from here, where he does very, very advanced procedures. Rahman Litzlan, no one should ever have to call him.
What was his last name?
Huss. So when I first spoke to him, he said that most people who call him, it's not for good things. So it was actually very nice that we had a chance to talk, and he was very gracious with his time to talk about his expertise, which is quite extensive, not anymore in this area of cancer work. He does other kinds. Hopefully nobody will ever meet him. And Dr. Avi Rosenbaum, he is a geneticist. He works in a genetic lab in Connecticut, and he has extensive knowledge of genetics. Again, one of the many areas that I don't know anything about, so he was very gracious with his time to fill me in on everything that he could. So the topic that we're going to tackle today can be pronounced in two different ways. It's either referred to as BRCA or BRCA, and women's health interventions, halachic perspectives. So this topic really does need experts. And it's a very sensitive topic. It's an exceedingly sensitive topic because I would venture to guess that many of the people in this room, especially those of us who are from Ashkenazi Jewish communities, are somehow connected to this in some way or another. And I am very mindful of the fact that this is a very real topic. It's not a theoretical topic. It's an absolutely real topic. The other unique situation about this topic is that it is evolving. It's one, according to Dr. Reichman, it's one of the most highly researched medical topics going on in the field of medicine right now. Like I have, through YU, I have access to medical journals, like various medical journals that physicians utilize. So just doing a little bit of research, just in the last 6 weeks, 4 major research papers have been published on BRCA and related topics. So obviously there's a wealth of information, and this information is constantly changing, literally week to week now. So what we're going to talk about, the different ideas we could consider today, they're going to be different in 6 months, and they're certainly going to be different in a year and in 5 years. The statistics will change, the recommendations will change, different perspectives will change. But it's an interesting area of exploration, since it's so cutting edge, to see how, on the one hand, halacha actually pushes and challenges the scientific community. Because the halachic man, the halachic person, is always looking for definitions and looking for facts. So when the halachist approaches a question, they're challenging the physicians and say, give me facts. Explain to me the parameters. Give me the numbers. But the opposite is also true, that in this case as well, like in every case, the science is pushing the halacha, because we have halachic questions now that we didn't have 5 years ago or 10 years ago or even 1 year ago. So the reason that I'm talking about this today is twofold. One is that a couple of months ago, there was a New York Times opinion piece written by a prominent Hollywood actress who describes her realization that she had a BRCA gene mutation and what she did about it. We'll talk about that in a little while. As well as there was big news, even if you don't follow that news, which I didn't know about until somebody sent it to me. Just that's not necessarily my sphere of interest. So it's all fine. I don't usually read the New York Times, nor is this actress a particular. I don't follow any actresses on Twitter, so I wouldn't know that this is going on. I don't use Twitter at all. But I follow the mainstream news, and there was a major landmark decision by the U.S. Supreme Court just a few weeks ago having to do with genetics and a company that has to do with BRCA. And the ruling was, in that case, that the BRCA gene that this company is based in Utah, it's called Myriad, had been testing for, they had held a patent over this gene. If somebody wanted to get a BRCA test, they had to use this company in Utah. It was something to the tune of $3,000 to $4,000, which according to Dr. Reichman is actually more than having your entire genome mapped today. So that is now no longer. There is no more a monopoly on this gene. There is a monopoly on synthetic genes, but not on the BRCA gene. And that's why it became big in the news, people talking about BRCA and what is it and how does it play out. So let's start from the beginning. And that's what you have an outline. Usually in a presentation that I share, as many of you know, I like to hand out a source packet. The problem is that in this circumstance, the source packet would have looked like this. So I opted just to give you an outline, and I'm happy to share an extended outline that has many more sources as part of it, but you can follow along and take notes if you'd like. If not, you can just listen. So the first thing to keep in mind when we talk about the question of how do we deal with a potential health question, which we haven't even defined yet exactly what it is, we need to take a step back and talk about the Torah's responsibility for a healthy lifestyle, for healthy living. And that can be rooted in different sources. The Gemara says in Brachos, there was a story of a man who was davening on the side of the road, and a king stopped him and was starting to talk to him, and the man didn't answer. And the king said, "What's wrong with you? Don't you know Chumash? Don't you know what it says in the Chumash? Raki shomer lecha ushmor nafshecha, and v'nishmartem me'od l'nafsho seichem. You have to be cautious about yourself. You have to take care of yourself. You know that in today's day and age, speaking in 3rd century Babylonia, I could kill you right on the spot and there would be no recourse. There would be no redress. That's the way it was. So how can you stand in the middle of your Shemone Esrei and not interrupt, because this is what we call pikuach nefesh. It's a dangerous, it's a life-threatening circumstance. And we know that life-threatening circumstances break almost all the rules, even Chilul Shabbos. We should immediately violate Shabbos to potentially save a life. So this is one source, an explicit passage in the Talmud that quotes two psukim, specifically most colloquially referred to as this pasuk of v'nishmartem ba'od l'nafsho seichem. You should be cautious about your souls, yourself, even though we could discuss at greater length the context of that is not having anything to do with health, but the rabbis understood that that means you have to take care of yourself. You have to lead a healthy lifestyle. And similarly, the Rambam writes in Hilchos Rotzeach, when he discusses a dangerous circumstances, let's say, and every once in a while you hear about this, unfortunately, in the news, somebody, they have a habit, they keep a Bengal tiger in their backyard. Just for, you know, whatever, they keep a Bengal tiger in their backyard. So the Rambam says that might run afoul of potential problems in the Chumash, and the Rambam writes that anything that you have in your home that's dangerous is a violation of the Torah. You can't have a swimming pool, for example, that doesn't have a fence around it. That's based on the derivative of the principle of makeh, of having a fence, and I allude to the low, the person shouldn't be megadol kelev ra, a dangerous animal, a dog. And the Rambam says, chola over aleihem, somebody who violates this, v'omer harini misakin ba'atzmi, and I don't care, makino so makas martus, you beat him with rabbinic lashes. If a person says, I don't care about my health, I'll go to pot, doesn't matter. The Rambam says, that's not allowed. And conversely, in a more proactive sense, the Rambam in Hilchos Deos says, look, our purpose in life is to bring godliness into the world. Well, a person who's sick, who's ill, they can't do that because they can't function properly. Well, if you can't function properly, you can't do your avodas Hashem. So obviously, says the Rambam, hol ve'yos haguf bari v'shalim midarkei Hashemu, a person obviously has to be healthy as part of their service of Hashem. Therefore, you have to have a healthy lifestyle. You have to stay away from Dvarim Hama'abdim Es Haguf, things that ruin your body. So there are many things that we shouldn't be eating or doing, etc. You know, and then you can discuss the various parameters of things that are potentially hazardous to our health, and we should avoid them. So at the first outset, we have to be careful about our health. We have to live a healthy lifestyle. And there's even one story in the Gemara that one of the students didn't come to the Beis Medrash one day, and his father, Rav Huna, said to his son, he said, why didn't you come to the Beis Medrash? He says, the rabbi is not talking Torah, he's just talking about random stuff. He's not saying anything of significance because I'm here to learn, and he's not saying any Torah, so I didn't show up. He says, really, what is he talking about? So he lists him all kinds of health advice that he tells him. You have to be careful to use the restroom and not to eat this and not to eat that. So his father, Rav Huna, responded to Rabbi. He says to him, you don't understand. This is something that you absolutely have to be there. Kol Shekein, certainly you have to go. Because if you don't know how to live a healthy life, so then you're not going to have a lot of time for studying Torah. So the first premise is that we are always careful about maintaining healthy lifestyle in a prophylactic sense. We always want to maintain a high level of health. Okay, that's number one. Similarly, on the opposite hand, if, God forbid, somebody gets sick, so they need to seek medical treatment. How do you know they should seek medical treatment? And they shouldn't just say, well, God ordained that they should be sick. So one is learned actually from Hashavas Aveda. In two different Gemaras, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, elsewhere, the Gemara says, wait a second, if I see somebody's wallet or purse lying on the floor, so I should pick it back and give it to them. So it's Hashavas Mamono, it's returning their money. If I see their health lying on the floor, so I should certainly return it to them. You know, a physician's obligation to help me is partially predicated on Hashavas Aveda. I come to their office, they look at me lying on the table, reklach, it's terrible, look at this guy's mom, she's terrible. So now I have a mitzvah, Hashavas Gufo. This physician actually gets this tremendous mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda, because now look at me, I'm back to myself. So that's one avenue. Then there's the other avenue that's probably more well known, is from the pasuk Virapo Yirape, that we should pursue, or we have the permission, the Talmud says, we have the permission to heal, and that means we have the responsibility to take care of ourselves. And the Ramban, Nachmanides, who lived in the 13th century, wrote a book called Toras HaAdam, where he talks about different aspects of a person's life cycle, and a lot of them have to do with health and end-of-life issues and avelos. And the Ramban writes there, don't think that just because I got sick, God ordained it that I should be sick. Not the case. I have to pursue health. And not only that, the Ramban in that discussion talks actually about medical liability, about the fact that doctors, physicians who are licensed, so they may, not out of ignorance, but just out of being human, they may make mistakes, and that's part of the practice. And you still go to them. It's not a guarantee that every surgeon is going to be perfect in every surgery, but you still go. The Ramban says, even though there is a possibility, they make a mistake. Number one, they have malpractice coverage from the Talmud. And number two, that's a longer discussion, different shiur than for today, but number two, says the Ramban, you have to go there even if it may or may not be perfect. So number one, we have to lead a healthy lifestyle. Number two, if we're sick, you got to go to the doctor. So that's kind of a general picture. The question is, what happens if we have a circumstance where I'm not, God forbid, I'm not right now in a situation of illness, but I may, at some point down the road, I may potentially become sick. So obviously, on one level, we have this issue about preventative care, so we addressed that already. But let's say I can anticipate it, I can identify whether or not I may become ill. So where does this come up? This comes up in the context of genetic screening. Because today, we can actually identify various potential risk factors for some serious illnesses. So what do we say? Wait a second. On the one hand, we say, there's a pasuk, Tomim Tiyem Hashem Elokecha. We should be faithful in God. And we don't like to look in the future. You know, if you drive down the street and you see, you know, palm reading somewhere, you know, I haven't seen it too much in Skokie, but driving to other places, you'll see there's a lot of advertisement for such things. So if you drive down the street and you have whatever, your local necromancer or somebody you happen to know, so the Torah says that's, maybe it's a parnasa for somebody, but it's not an Eitz HaTovah for you. We don't seek out the future. Only if you have a prophet. So very good. I haven't seen a prophet in a few thousand years, so we're not looking for the future. Today we're not looking for the future. So maybe you should say, look, I should have bitachon, which I certainly should have. I have to have emuna that the Ribono Shel Olam is going to take care of me, and whatever is supposed to happen to me is supposed to happen to me. So do you say that? Or do you say, wait a second, I've got to figure out what to do, because maybe such and such is the case, and I have to prepare for it. So how do you balance having a culture and a sense of emuna in your home, in your life, in your community, with prudent kind of planning? So this is a bigger question. Both Rav Moshe Feinstein, Zecher Tzadik V'Kadosh Levrach, and Lahavdil Ben Chaim L'Chaim Rav Avadya Yosef, have a tshuva about this in the context of life insurance. Because on the one end, you say to yourself, wait a minute, why am I taking out life insurance? I have bitachon, the Baruch Shalom will take care of me. On the other hand, you have to have preventative measures. So they both assume that life insurance is permitted, perhaps even prudent, perhaps even suggested. But the Rabbi J.D. Bleich, who authored an article on the topic of genetic screening, tribal and tradition, he points out a mashal from the Chafetz Chaim, which is an important observation. He says that it's important to think about the following circumstance. Let's say I'm crossing Dempster. Some of you have driven on Dempster just this morning. So here you are at Dempster. So you have a few thousand cars that cross Dempster every single day. So I'm standing at the corner of Hamlin and Dempster, and I'm going south. And I say to myself, you know what? I have bitachon. I'm going to close my eyes. I'm just going to go for it. I know some people who drive like that. They just pull out, and they just go. You know? They just go. That's their style. They have a lot of bitachon. No problem. Everyone else, just move out of the way. Do they just drive like that? So they have a high level of bitachon, and they just go. So Chafetz Chaim says, that's not an etzah. Open your eyes. You'll see there are hundreds of cars whizzing down the road. So it's not a chuser bitachon. It's not an absence, a lacuna of bitachon, to open your eyes when you cross the street. That's just seichel. The famous, Rabbi Bleich points out, there's an old joke. A guy is standing there. He's a big baal bitachon. So he's standing there. We'll use contemporary terms. It's his house in Skokie and Timber Ridge. His mom's getting flooded. It hasn't been flooded like this since last week. So it's getting so flooded. Mamish, the rain is coming in the basement. The water is coming up and coming up. And he sees coming by on a canoe is somebody from the village. And they start yelling out to him, come on, get in the canoe. He says, no, I'm a baal bitachon, no problem. So the canoe goes by. Then, Mamish, the water goes up. So comes the rescue boat from the village. Says, oh, no problem. Now he's on the roof. And he sees that there's a helicopter. He says, no helicopter. He says, I'm a baal bitachon. So finally, the whole house gets washed away. And he's sitting here on the top of a tree looking up, Ribono Shel Olam. He says, what happened? I'm a baal bitachon. So there's a baskel that comes out. He says, I sent you a canoe. I sent you a rowboat. I sent you a helicopter. You should have taken it. What do you want from me now? So Rabbi Bleich points out that there is a balance between bitachon on one hand and caution on the other hand. In general, in halacha, this is it's a gentle and important balance. We have practices that we do that are dangerous. We do. We drive. Driving is dangerous. Crossing the street is dangerous. Lots of things that we do are dangerous. Flying is dangerous. Everything has a certain degree of risk, but we do things that are dangerous. So what do we say? Why do we do things that are dangerous? We say, a pasuk, Shomer Psoim Hashem. God watches the simple people. We have emuna that if we're going to do whatever safety precautions are regularly accepted in the community, a.k.a. fastening your safety belt, you know, put the buckle one side into the other side, so that will protect you against all ills, because the Ribono Shel Olam, the Ribono Shel Olam will help us. Shomer Psoim Hashem. Yes, so that's on one hand. On the other hand, we don't encourage people to go, I don't know, bungee jumping without a bungee cord. What do you say? Shomer Psoim Hashem, God will take care of me. I'm going to jump off the third story window because I believe the Ribono Shel Olam is going to take care. So obviously there's a healthy balance there. So the Gemara has an expression of Dashu Bei Rabim. It's something that people they're comfortable with. Everybody's comfortable. I shouldn't say everybody. 99.9% of people are comfortable driving. They're not nervous about driving. So in that case, we say Shomer Psoim Hashem. But if it's something that people are nervous about, you don't say Shomer Psoim Hashem. You know, the question of how cautious versus how much bitachon goes into the mix there as well. So in terms of practicality, genetic screening, you can ask the same question. Do we say, Shomer Psoim Hashem, I'm going to go on my way? Or do we say, no, you have to take precautions? So Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva that was written years ago about Tay Sachs. And Rav Moshe rules that even though we are concerned. We want to make sure to have a firm rooting in emunah and bitachon. On the other hand, he says, it's just like opening your eyes when you cross the street, because it's right there, and it's easily, readily available. And therefore, Moshe encourages, he says, it's mistaber that we should have, it's appropriate to screen for tasex. That was his ruling at the time. Similarly, in a different ruling, in a different country, Rebbe Eliezer Yehuda Waldenberg, the author of the Tzitz Eliezer, a multi-volume library, it's like 20 volumes. So he was asked by a particular school in Yerushalayim, should the school mandate that the children get eye exams? Should they encourage the parents to mandate, should they enforce that the parents have to get their kids to have eye exams? Should they have the Medina make sure they have money for people to help them, you know, as part of the health insurance plan, people should get eye exams? Because they talk, this discussion here is that the school children, they're looking in the books and therefore they're at risk for short-sightedness, which is potential risk down the road for some other eye diseases. So Rav Waldenberg says, yes, yes, it's halachically required that they should get eye exams. So in a certain sense, eye exams, and again, these are eye exams not when kids are sick, beforehand. So the same way that we would encourage, in a certain sense, genetic screening and eye exams, so we would also potentially suggest this as well. So now becomes the question, because we will raise the question of how do we feel about genetic testing for various genetic diseases. So Moshe has his tshuva about Tay-Sachs, and then there became a battery of other genes that are associated to some greater proportion in the Ashkenazi Jewish community. Let's use Ashkenazi Jews for a second. So how much do we encourage? So this is a good question in general when it comes to genetic testing. So Dr. Eichmann said that when he speaks in communities, and he speaks all over the world, he asks people what they think about genetic testing in the realm of whether it should be open or closed. Should people get tested and know what's in their genetic pool, or should they rather not know? And he said that generally when they take a survey, which is, we're not going to do that today, he said it's usually 50-50. Some people prefer, yes, they should know, and others actually, in the same, imagine we took the survey here, others prefer not, they don't want to be weighed down by that information. So all that is just a backup, as background, for the overview of what the American Cancer Society has to say about cancer today, and specifically two kinds of cancer, which are related to this situation with BRCA. The first is breast cancer. And that is that, according to the literature, 1 in 8 women, and when I read this, I couldn't believe it, 1 in 8 women in the United States over the course of their lifetime is going to be affected by breast cancer.
Their lifetime?
Yeah.
Their lifetime means that
right.
Very misleading. It doesn't mean one person is going to get their lifetime. And lifetime for women in the U.S. is really long. So.
Right, but.
It's very misleading.
So let me say it a different way. About 232,340 new cases of invasive breast cancer are diagnosed every year, and 39,620 deaths in women are attributed to breast cancer every single year. It's the most common cancer among women in the United States other than skin cancer. So it's once in your lifetime, but over the course of a person's lifetime, you're talking about 1 in 8 women, and according to the American Cancer Society, it says that 1 in 36 women have the chance of dying from breast cancer. Now, it doesn't mean dying at age 30, it doesn't mean dying at age 50, it could be dying at age 107. But that this is a serious, life-threatening disease is something that needs to be recognized. That's on one side of the equation. Then there's another women-related disease in the cancer family, and that is ovarian cancer, much smaller. They have reported about, and this is as of 2013, 22,240 cases annually of ovarian cancer, with 14,230 reported deaths. And the chances of getting this over the course of a lifetime is 1 in 72, while the chance of dying from ovarian cancer is 1 in 100. So these are some of the facts. I'm not a physician, I'm just telling you what there is, and you can see the research that I did is based on the various health organizations that are listed. You can look them up on the bottom of your outline. Now, that's generally true about all women in the world. Now, there is an additional set of factors that contribute to whether a person has a higher risk for these kind of diseases. Part of it is hereditary. Somewhere between 9 and 16%, let's say, when it comes to breast cancer, is hereditary. It's related to the person's family. There are many, many other factors. One of these factors has to do with our genes. Okay, so what are genes? So, I hadn't thought about this in many years, but I remembered, only after doing the research, that I have 23 pairs of chromosomes. Who would have thought? I never noticed that. I didn't come up in the last many years, let's just say. So we have, every person has 23 pairs of chromosomes. You have 46 chromosomes, and in these chromosomes you have genes, little markers, that tell us everything that we are supposed to have in our body. All the things that make us up are listed on these chromosomes, and if I make a mistake here, somebody who has more scientific knowledge than me, please feel free to interrupt. We have, according to the Human Genome Project, which was started in 1990 and didn't finish, it was supposed to finish in 15 years, they finished in 2003 earlier. They mapped the full human genome, and they found between 20 and 25,000 genes on every person. Each one of us has between 20 and 25,000 genes between these two sets of 23 chromosomes. Now, each of these genes has different... It goes through a different life. Sometimes it's operating at full capacity, sometimes it's not operating properly, but different times, different lives, different times in our life, our genes are operating different ways. And the genes are essentially giving instructions to our body how to function. So, as part of this gene, and I could show you a picture, but I don't have a screen, it just looks like, you know, little fingers off this gene. You've probably learned this in high school the same time I learned it, was that there is a genetic marker on genes number, on chromosomes number 17 and number 13, which has been labeled as BRCA1 and BRCA2. And these genes have a specific job. Their job, BRCA1 and BRCA2, is to kill cancer cells. Cancer cells, as I have learned, are cells that continuously grow and grow and grow and grow in an unhealthy way. Because usually we have cells, they grow, and then they die and they replace other cells. But when you have cells that keep growing and growing and growing and growing, so then that becomes a terribly unhealthy situation, and it plays itself out in different parts of the body, in different forms of illness, Rahmanul Islan, Hashem should save us all from any such circumstance. So what happens is, if that person has BRCA1, everybody has BRCA1, so that BRCA1 is going to help kill cancer cells that are developing in their body. But what if there's a mutation in their BRCA1? So first of all, there could be lots of different mutations, maybe even 100 different potential mutations in the BRCA1 gene. So if a person has a mutation in one of these genes, that means that their cancer-killing ability is diminished. And therefore, they have a greater risk of developing cancer, specifically two kinds of cancer. Now, this is true, this potential mutation is true both in men and in women. A man can also have a BRCA gene mutation, but what that means is that a person who has a mutation in their BRCA gene, that's taking away from their ability to fight cancer, even if it's not in both of their genes. See, some genes, they only become problematic because we get one set from our father, one set from our mother. So if one set of the genes is malfunctioning, the other one will compensate. That's called a recessive gene. And therefore, it's only a recessive problem if there's only going to be a problem if they become linked together and that now both sides are not functioning, then we have a problem. Here, you need both genes, both BRCA genes, to be functioning 100% so that you can kill the cancer cells. So what happens if a person has a problem? So according to the NIH, so as we said before, over the course of a lifetime, 12% of women will develop breast cancer, but that risk is increased five times, four times, maybe as much as 80% chance that this woman will develop breast cancer. And possibly even men could develop breast cancer because of this, because of having this genetic predisposition. If they have the BRCA abnormality, they have this potential, some 40, 60, 80 possible percent chance that they will develop breast cancer, and it changes over the course of life. As we get older, we have different risks, so this risk becomes increased and increased. And similarly, although not quite as advanced, ovarian cancer as well, 1.4% of women will be diagnosed with ovarian cancer, compared with 15 to 40% of women who have a harmful BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutation. Now, keep in mind, many things contribute. Family and all kinds of unidentified things. In the next 20 years, we'll probably find a million other things that contribute to potential risk for breast cancer. But right now, we can identify that these are risk factors. So now, the question is, so what happens? So do we encourage, how do we view testing for the BRCA gene? So questions come up. Number one, who gets tested? So the general guidelines that are out there that I found, and you can research them, is that, as we said before, there are many factors. So even though in the Ashkenazi population, let's say in the general population, how many people are running around there out there in the street with a mutated BRCA1 gene? Less than 1%. About 0.5%, let's say. But in the Ashkenazi Jewish population, about 2.5%, about four times the number of risk factors exist in Ashkenazi Jewish women. So now you have a group of people who are at four times the level of risk, but remember, it's still only 2.5% risk. On the other hand, you know, 2.5% risk, that's a serious risk. You know, that's one in, like, 1 in 40, something like that. So if I had... if I had 40 camp children and I was taking them across the street and for some unwise reason I was going to have them run and beat the red light, and I figured that's okay, it's only a chance that one of them is not going to make it across the street. I mean, like, what's the big deal? 1 in 40. So most of you probably wouldn't entrust your children to me as the camp counselor. You know what I'm saying? That's not the advisable course of action. So now, on the one hand, it's only 2.5%. On the other hand, 2.5% is a real percent. So according to the guidelines that are out there, women who have the BRCA gene mutation, I'm sorry, women who have a family history are encouraged to get a BRCA gene test. Now, that is different between having a family history in general or having a family history and being part of the Ashkenazi Jewish population. If your family history in general, so then you have to have, and there are different permutations of this, either two first-degree relatives or a first-degree and a second-degree or three first-degree, depending on who you ask. As opposed to if you're an Ashkenazi Jewish woman, so you already have a greater risk, so then people would encourage you, if you have one relative, first-degree relative, who has had an instance of breast cancer, then you should be worried. We're going to take care of that. We need to get tested for the BRCA gene. So that's kind of what people are saying, as far as I can understand, based on the research. Now, there are different kinds of tests. There is this basic general BRCA test, and there's a more advanced test. But keeping in mind the idea of encouraging people to test, it's complicated. So number one, what exactly are you going to do if you find out about this? We're going to have to talk about that in a little bit. But that's going to impact who's going to get tested. Are you going to take every, 15-year-old girl who comes from an Ashkenazi Jewish family? Are you going to have them get tested for the BRCA1 gene? Are you going to take every 40-year-old woman, every 60-year-old woman? How do you decide who is it going to be based on? It'll probably, part of it is going to depend on where they're at in life. The converse is, you have someone who gets tested. Let's say they're not going to do anything right now, but then they have this enormous burden. They have this enormous psychological burden on their shoulder, feeling like, Ribbono Shalom, perhaps they might even feel, Rahman Salam, they might feel like a ticking time bomb, God forbid, because they have this knowledge. So there's a position that would advocate, look, especially if you're not going to do anything right now, then don't get tested right away. That's also part, I would say that's part of the equation. Even if you don't get tested, or even if a person gets tested and is negative, there are potential for false negatives. It doesn't mean that this is the answer for everything, but it's something to keep in mind in terms of the cost. I believe, as far as I could tell in the research, the insurance companies generally cover this, although that also would be an interesting discussion. If a person found out that they had a BRCA gene mutation, so what does that mean for their employer? What does that mean for other implications? Obviously, there's legal protection against discrimination, but this is an interesting question. Something needs to be looked at. And now with the change in the Myriad ruling from the Supreme Court, so this is something that's going to be over time being reevaluated, because Myriad's not going to have the monopoly anymore. Mm-hmm. So it's now 3 o'clock. I'm going to take another 15 minutes to address this topic. Anybody who doesn't have time, please roll. So a person gets, let's say, a woman opts that she's going to get the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genetic screening. And they found out that they do have this genetic marker. They have this mutation. So obviously, there's a great need for emotional counseling and support. So you need to talk to a genetic counselor. There is a decision how to move forward. It doesn't mean, by the way, it doesn't mean that this gene, by the way, has to be moved on to the next generation. Today, with medical advances, with what's called PGD, pre-implantation genetic determination, through the use of in vitro fertilization, we could actually eradicate all BRCA1 and BRCA2 mutations. Because if every couple who had a BRCA mutation was able to choose the embryo of their child, which could be done now, and check the DNA to make sure that there were no genetic malfunctions, so then we would eradicate all BRCA from the next generation. But that's a very extreme position. That's a very costly measure. Emotionally, it's not easy. Halakhically, it's very questionable. But the concept exists. So then we come to the main question, which is interventions. So one level, Tzigzun, of interventions has to do with monitoring, very aggressive monitoring. That's part of the discussion in the literature about women who either have a family history and or are at risk because they have a BRCA1 mutation. So there is aggressive monitoring that takes place with their in consultation with their physician over the course of time to make sure that nothing occurs. Like we said, it's only a risk factor, it's a guarantee. Then there is a discussion in the literature about a hormone therapy, which... Well, that's the point. If they have a BRCA gene mutation, they undergo heavy, heavy monitoring. Meaning today, so 3 years ago, there was actually a big hullabaloo that was caused because the guidelines for mammograms were changed. And now, according to the official mammogram, it's about 50 as opposed to 40, which it was previously. So you would, in this case, apparently less than 40 mammograms are not, according to Dr. Huss and others, they're not so effective in identifying, but there are other ways of checking. So they would argue for earlier mammograms, perhaps more often, and other kinds of checking to be very cautious about this. So that's option one. Option two is this hormone therapy that has a lot of potential side effects. And option three is prophylactic surgery, because surgery, and again, there's a lot of research that's being done on this right now. This is a question. It will certainly reduce the risk. It won't eliminate risk because tissue cannot be removed completely, although in the case of an oophorectomy, the removal of the ovaries, that's almost everything is gone. But this becomes another question. So there is a discussion in halakhic literature that began in the days of inoculation, which we call today vaccinations. Should you take a perfectly healthy person and inject them with a bug, a disease, and assume that that's going to prevent them from getting this disease in a more serious way? So that was an interesting halakhic discussion, and one could suggest, here you have the same thing. Should we subject a woman, or should she subject herself to a medical procedure when she's totally healthy right now, so that later on there could potentially be a benefit? That's one way of looking at it. A different way of looking at it is, perhaps this woman is already in a state of danger. Maybe she feels like she's in a suffix pikuach nefesh already, because she knows, let's say if she has the BRCA1 plus a family history, she's perhaps an 80% risk, some would say, maybe 60, maybe 40, maybe 80% risk of getting breast cancer. So then she should say maybe she's already in a degree of danger. Well, if you're already in a degree of danger, then you have a greater halachic latitude to pursue different options. So there are two different models, I think, pretty multiple different models that we could undergo in terms of looking at this question. In general, like we said before, we always take risks when we drive, when we cross the street. So we have to think about how do we take risks in the realm of halacha. Let's say, God forbid, here's a third model that we need to consider. This is an extreme model, wouldn't be until down the road, but it's something to think about. Let's say, God forbid, somebody had an illness and their physician recommended that they have an operation, a kind of surgery, and it's a risky surgery. These surgeries that we're talking about, according to Dr. Huss and Dr. Reifman, are very, very low risk. They may have risks of infection, but they have very, very low mortality, almost insignificant probably from a halachic standpoint. But let's say you had something that had a higher degree of mortality concern. So would you tell the patient, undergo this risky procedure? Well, you have the benefit of X number of life expectancy if it goes well. But if it doesn't go well, how long would you live? So this is a big debate, big discussion in halachic literature. Rav Herschel Schechter Shalita, in one of his published essays, discusses a case of an individual who says, look, they have X number of months, the doctors tell them they have X number of months to live, and they want to know, the doctor recommending or asking if they should have such and such a procedure. Are they obligated? Are they permitted? What's the risk? Back and forth. How long would they live afterwards? So these are some of the very complex questions that will also, as a third model, figure in here, depending on how much risk there would be. In this particular case, these kind of procedures are not much risk at all. They might even be compared to a fourth model, which could be looked at as elective surgery or cosmetic surgery. So this became a discussion in the poskim. The plurality of opinions in the poskim is that elective surgery, cosmetic surgery, is permitted. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva where he discusses this topic. I guess, I don't know, when you get your ears pierced, does it cause bleeding? Some people said no, some people said, I've never had my ears pierced, so I don't know. A little bit. So great. So here's a shiloh. Can you have your ears pierced? So the problem with the bleeding is that it causes, maybe she had clip-ons. I don't know. So here's the question. Let's take pierced ears for a second. Am I allowed to punch my ear and cause myself to bleed? That's a problem of chavala, of wounding. And a person, the Rambam points out that wounding anybody else or yourself, the Kesem Mishnah explains, my body's not mine, it belongs to the Almighty. Wounding myself is an issur d'oraisa. So are you allowed to wound yourself, so to speak? So Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva where he rules that it's permitted because the issur of chavala, of lo yosef, not beating somebody up, quotes in the Rambam, is not derech nitzayon, in abusive manner. So, I guess depending on the eye of the beholder, it would seem that no one's being abused when they punch their hole in their ear, unless it's being done like in the classroom with a hole puncher. That's not an abusive circumstance. So therefore, elective surgery, cosmetic surgery, that's not derech nitzayon. People sign up for that. They pay money for it. They're not being abused, and therefore it'd be permitted. So here too, we fold that into the equation. Let's say it's not an issue of danger, but even just an issue of prophylactic surgery from a cosmetic standpoint. So in terms of the potential procedures themselves, so there are two potential procedures. The one that was discussed in this article by Angelina Jolie is a mastectomy. So in halacha, you have to look at it from different levels. Number one, you have the issue of sakana. Is it dangerous? So as we pointed out before, these procedures, according to the doctors that I spoke to, are not really dangerous. They have a risk of infection, but they don't, and they have a risk of going wrong, but they don't themselves carry a risk of danger. So then that goes back to the question, how much danger? It sounds like not so much danger. Chavala, we mentioned a second ago, could be that's not a problem with chavala. After this happens, there is an article by a woman, I forget the other one, who wrote with her, Dr. Dina Zimmerman. So she, I think actually she works with Rabbanit Henkin at Nishmat, and she is a physician, and she writes scholarly articles about medicine. So she has a tradition article where she points out there may be chatzitza questions when it comes to tevila, when a person undergoes a surgery like this. But that's a temporary phase, but that's something to think about. Dr. Reichman pointed out, the most understudied of all the effects of this is the psychological effect. And in halacha, we take psychology very much into consideration. It's a very serious thing for a person to be in a state of mind of aggravation or pain. And Dr. Huss pointed out to me that many patients who are facing these kind of challenges suffer depression. And you can go online and read some of the testimonials of women who have dealt with this terrible, terrible, difficult situation. I can't even imagine, lo aleinu. We have to be so, so careful in understanding the sensitivity to someone who's facing such a life-changing potential situation. So, you know, there's one thing to have a surgery, but Dr. Huss pointed out to me that many women, they find that this concept of a mastectomy, it turns their whole world upside down. It could be they view it as the end of their feminine aspect. So it's a very, very difficult thing. So you can't take that lightly. That halacha would also take into consideration. So these are some of the factors. And Rav Schechter points out in his essay that in many circumstances in halacha, we dictate what has to happen, but in many circumstances in halacha, there is a measure of autonomy. So number one, in this particular circumstance, it's not a guarantee, it's a risk factor. So there's a measure of leeway. And then there are the questions of back and forth. Then there's the oophorectomy, the removal of the ovaries, which has its own set of issues. Number one, the question of childbearing years. So would somebody, would a woman who's 18 years old decide that she's going to have her ovaries removed and never have any children? This is a very difficult question. There's a further halachic issue that's regarding the issue of sirus, of actively making somebody infertile. So this is a longer discussion, but there's a distinction between sirus of castration in men and in women. And the halachic literature points out there's a greater level of leniency. There's no, the Rambam has a quote, the Gemara says, Ein sirus be'isha. The Rambam says, it's pater aval aser. It's restricted, but it's not a violation. So the question is, what exactly does that mean? So most authorities assume that actual, proactive removing of the reproductive organs of a woman is a rabbinic restriction. It's an iser derabanan. Well, if it's an iser derabanan, so if Moshe Feinstein points out in the tshuva, if it's a circumstance of danger, so then we forego the iser derabanan. And the Nishmas Avram, Dr. Abraham, in his very thick compendium on halacha and medicine, points out, he quotes from Rav Ovadia Yosef in the tshuva, that even if it's a case of tsar gadol, of great anguish, so we would forego the rabbinic restriction against the removal of the reproductive organs. So the question of sirus also would be addressed potentially in this context. So the question at the end of the day is, well, what do you do? So I put on your sheet an allusion to a symposium that's published online by YU Torah from 5 years ago with a prominent oncologist, Dr. Stanley Weintraub, and Rabbi Mordechai Willig, and a genetic counselor. So Rabbi Willig said that you are mechuyev to do what the doctors tell you to do. So that is that's a very, very wise psak. The challenge is, and this is what Rabbi Neuberger pointed out, is that obviously it's hard, you can't argue with that, but it's hard to know today. Because even the doctors themselves, as Dr. Us and Dr. Reichman pointed out to me, that it's evolving. So Dr. Us pointed out that there is no one formula. He suggested that depending on the age of the woman and the stage in life she is and where she's up to and what she's willing and interested in undergoing, that will have the defining recipe, the formula for how they should go about leading their life. Because that is going to fall within some of the parameters. Again, this is just a survey, just that we should be sensitive to this issue, to be sensitive to the fact that there are people in our community that are struggling with this issue. I think information certainly is helpful. You know, to go beyond what the doctor orders, the doctor order says this, and you want to go beyond that? So Rabbi Neuberger says he's not so sure that we should argue that people should go above and beyond what the physicians tell us, but to follow the guidance of our physicians. So that's what the Ramban already pointed out. We should try as best as we can to daven the Rebbe Shalom, should keep us all healthy. And it should be Shomer all of Klal Yisrael, and it should be Merapi all the Cholim. I want to thank you for